While the 2006 ASCO meeting was not quite as exciting as the 2005 trastuzumab bevacizumab spectacular, there were, as always, many important new data sets reported, and among the most discussed was a trial in patients with HER2-positive tumors progressing on trastuzumab, which reported a significant progression-free survival advantage to the combination of the dual tyrosine kinase inhibitor lapatinib combined with capecitabine compared to capecitabine alone. Dr. Charles Geyer presented these exciting data at ASCO and met with me to review the findings and clinical implications. Dr. Geyer began by reviewing the trial design.
The study was a phase 3 randomized trial looking at lapatinib, which is a dual kinase EGFR and HER2 inhibitor, oral tyrosine kinase inhibitor, combining that with capecitabine versus capecitabine alone in patients who had progressive metastatic breast cancer. All the women were to have received previous anthracycline and a taxane in either the adjuvant or metastatic setting, and they were all supposed to have received Herceptin in the metastatic setting. And when we looked at the CRFs, fortunately, the investigators were, for the most part, compliant with those recommendations. So in looking at the data, it really was a group of patients where the large majority had indeed received trastuzumab for metastatic disease and progressed. So we did get the population that we hoped for, a more resistant group of women.
Now, obviously, these people had HER2-positive tumors.
Yeah, they had to have 3+ on IHC or amplified by FISH to be eligible for the study. They had to have normal EF, measurable disease, still reasonably good performance status, ECOG 0 or 1, even though they were pretreated. And the therapy was basically randomizing them to the approved dose of the capecitabine, the 2,500 per meter dose, or the dose of capecitabine and lapatinib that had been worked out in phase 1, bringing the capecitabine down to 2,000, which is sort of the standard U.S. dose anyway, combined with 1,250 per day of lapatinib. The lapatinib's on a continuous basis, and the capecitabine state 1 through 14 every 21 days.
And before you get into the results, can you backtrack a little bit and talk a little bit more about what the mechanism of action is, presumably, of lapatinib? We're seeing more TKIs being used in oncology in general. What do we know about specifically exactly what it inhibits?
Well, the TKIs as a class bind to the tyrosine kinase portion of generally these transmembrane receptors and compete with the phosphorylation. Basically, they compete with pyrophosphate so that you don't get phosphorylation, activation, and then downstream signaling. And in the case with the HER2 family, of course, there's the dimerization that is taking place, so you're blocking the phosphorylation that occurs. These sites are structurally different enough so that the companies have been able to some extent design drugs that bind to specific receptors, though there is clearly overlap with the small molecules. Not many of them are totally selective for one of the receptors. Lapatinib actually binds to HER1, HER2, HER3, HER4, the whole family, but the activity, as far as we know, is mainly through its interactions with HER2 and then presumably also with HER1.
What about EGFR? You mentioned that. How does that compare to the other EGFR TKIs?
Well, its inhibition of the EGFR is on a similar order of magnitude, so it does bind, and so you see side effects, skin toxicities, diarrhea that you see with the pure EGFR inhibitors with the drug. But clearly its distinct mechanism of action is that it also potently inhibits the HER2.
And I guess it seems like we're getting more and more data that EGFR TKIs really aren't going to be that helpful in breast cancer. Is that your take?
So far, it appears to be the case that that doesn't seem to be the dominant driver of breast cancers. There's still, I think, the interest in the possibility that perhaps a larger portion of that relatively rare group might be driven in part by EGFR, and so maybe there could be some benefits there. But the thinking with the preclinical data on the lapatinib basically revolved around the fact that it seemed that the EGFR probably is an enabler to a certain extent of HER2 in terms of perhaps evolving resistance, and that by blocking both, you do get a greater inhibition of the downstream signal. It's been seen in some of the preclinical models that justified going ahead with the trial.
So can you present the results?
Basically, the study was set up originally looking for an improvement in median time to progression from 3 months to 4.5 months. So, you know, being a pretreated group, it was thought that the capecitabine activity in HER2-positive patients would probably be, the median time to progression would be about 3 months, and 4.5 months was felt to be reasonable, though given that it would only have been improvement in time to progression by 1.5 months, overall survival was also initially felt to be something that needed to be looked at as well. So the original sample size was 528 patients in order to be able to see survival at the end as well as the time to progression. But like all the large phase 3 studies, there was an interim monitoring plan that was built into the trial. The final evaluation for time to progression was supposed to occur with 266 events, and the interim was 133, half of that basically. So the plan with the trial, and this was discussed, of course, with FDA, a problem with a study like this where you have open label, docs know, patients know who's getting lapatinib, who isn't, is that you do have potential for bias influencing the assessment of the endpoint. So it was planned to have all the studies that were done sent to a blinded independent radiology committee, basically, that would be the ones who would actually read the entire, all films on all the patients and determine who met the criteria for response and when the progressions occurred. So when the study got to past the 133 patient mark, there was a data lock as of November 15th of last year. There were actually 114 events by that point that 321 patients entered. So all 321 patients' films were reviewed, and the IRC said, we see 114 that meet the criteria for the study. And the analysis for time to progression was then driven on 114 events. Went to the Independent Data Monitoring Committee, and they saw that the study had crossed the O'Brien-Fleming boundaries for early reporting by a wide margin. We saw, first of all, the capecitabine group did better than anticipated. Instead of 3 months, it was 4.5 months. But the group getting the capecitabine and the lapatinib was out at 8.5 months. So there was nearly a doubling of median time to progression. Also, response rate was improved from roughly 14% to 22%. So clearly it was an active regimen. The other important aspect of what the DMC looked at, of course, was the safety data. Really, there was very minimal grade 4 toxicities. Only 1% or 2% of patients had grade 4 diarrhea on the combination arm, just a few. So it was really a surprisingly well-tolerated regimen, since there is overlap of the toxicities. When you look at the drugs individually, there was a concern that there would be significant synergy, so to speak, in terms of toxicity, but it wasn't there. So based on the efficacy as well as the safety, the IDMC made the recommendation that the accrual be closed, the results announced, and patients who were still receiving control be offered lapatinib, and that's all unfolded over the past few months.
You mentioned the rash, and it seems like oncologists now are starting to become dermatologists. We have so many agents that cause rash. Can you put this one in perspective in terms of how commonly it's a really bad problem?
The number of patients coming off therapy with the combination arm was 14% versus 11%. So with the dose modifications, it wasn't a problem. I think it will be something that will have to be watched as it gets moved into earlier settings. Certainly in the adjuvant setting, it will be interesting to see the impact of the rash in the adjuvant trials, earlier setting, how much tolerance patients would have there.
Was this a double-blind?
No, it was open label.
Right.
So there is potential for reporting biases then, but even with that, there really wasn't a lot of difference.
Where do you see things heading, both in terms of clinical research utilizing lapatinib as well as clinical care? Maybe I can start out with a clinical issue right now. If you see a patient, if the drug were available, and I guess it's going to be hopefully available pretty soon, who fits the criteria of the trial, progressing on trastuzumab, how do you think you would treat a patient right now?
I think patients that meet the eligibility criteria of the trial certainly should be offered lapatinib when it becomes available. My understanding is the company has been working with the FDA, and there will be a compassionate use trial that will be very broad-based. I mean, physicians can call and get the protocol and get it through whatever IRB mechanism they have and have it available for their patients in their practice fairly quickly.
What do you know about the combination of lapatinib and trastuzumab?
They have done phase one studies of the combination, and they did find that at full doses of trastuzumab and full doses around 1,500 of lapatinib, there was significant fatigue. So the combination that is tolerable brings the lapatinib down to 1,000. But it is an active regimen. They've looked at it in patients who are candidates for trastuzumab, and it's an active regimen that I think will clearly need evaluation.
What went into the selection of capecitabine, and do you think it would be rational to consider in a non-protocol setting with compassionate use, whatever, utilizing lapatinib with another chemotherapeutic agent or by itself without chemotherapy?
Rationale for the capecitabine was these were patients who had progressed through anthracycline taxane, and that's the indication for capecitabine. There was also some preclinical work that suggested EGF blockade might potentiate capecitabine activity a little bit, so I think it was a reasonable combination to evaluate. GSK is doing a large study looking at lapatinib with Taxol versus Taxol alone in frontline, so it certainly appears to combine well with paclitaxel. Since it is a small molecule, you have to be careful about just combining it with any drug. I don't think the work with Taxotere is as far along as it is with paclitaxel. So I think initially it will be made available just with the capecitabine combination. Once it's approved, then, you know, I think people will start looking at it with other combinations. But I think it will be important to make certain that the combinations that are used in the clinic have been evaluated and there's a pretty well-described dose and schedule to avoid unexpected toxicities.
What about lapatinib without chemotherapy?
The company is doing studies of lapatinib. I mean, there is single-agent activity in trastuzumab refractory patients. That's part of, you know, the early testing was showing its low level of activity. I think its main utility will probably be with chemotherapy from what I've seen. There is some phase one, phase two data that does show activity. So it would be, you know, if you get into that situation of a patient that had trastuzumab-resistant disease and wasn't a candidate for any chemotherapy, would it be a reasonable thing to try? I mean, I think that you could consider that, sure.
You mentioned trials looking at lapatinib combined with other chemotherapeutic agents. What about other settings, and particularly the adjuvant setting?
The excitement to me about the results of the lapatinib study really relate to the fact that I think there clearly is now a second very effective drug at shutting down the HER2 axis. In HER2-positive breast cancer patients, that this data just reinforces what we've clearly learned from Herceptin, that really keeping that axis quiet, so to speak, is the main thing that one wants to do when treating those patients. Because it seems Herceptin makes lots of chemotherapy drugs work a whole lot better. Clearly, when you've got a second drug that can shut that axis down, that works in a different way, obvious questions are, well, are there patients where one is better than the other? Are there patients where lapatinib, say, will be better than trastuzumab? Are there patients where the combination will be better? So I think these are things that will clearly need to be looked at in earlier frontline, neoadjuvant, adjuvant. Personally, I think it makes sense to take the step into the neoadjuvant setting first. I think the data in the lapatinib capecitabine, the activity there is strong enough to justify doing neoadjuvant therapy in patients who have not received trastuzumab, and then post-op you can come in and give them Herceptin trastuzumab, and they're still getting standard therapy. For me, it's a bit of a jump right now to go no Herceptin, just lapatinib in the adjuvant setting, personally.
Speaking of neoadjuvant studies, that's a good segue into an update on the NSABP breast trials. And I'm curious where things are right now in terms of neoadjuvant trials in the HER2-positive patient. At one point, you all were considering trying to look at Buzdar's regimen with the trastuzumab and anthracycline simultaneously. Where are you right now in your thinking?
Yeah, we had been working with ACOSOG to develop a trial to look in more depth at the Buzdar regimen, kind of comparing it to the standard sequential anthracycline followed by Taxol Herceptin. But basically, the support for the trial fell through. So that left us without the support that we felt like we needed to do the trial the way we thought it should be done. So we are in the process of developing a replacement study and are working on a straightforward concept comparing Herceptin versus lapatinib versus a combination neoadjuvant setting using an AC followed by a weekly paclitaxel template. All patients will get that basic chemotherapy program. The HER2 blockade will start with the paclitaxel.
That sounds great.
And they'll have surgery to determine PCR. And after surgery, then all the patients will receive Herceptin to get a year of blockade so that they will be getting standard therapy, in a sense, with Herceptin. But we'll have the information. We'll be able to get the baseline tissue and do the correlative work to see if we can start sorting out which patients might do better with each of the drugs individually or are those that can be identified as doing better with the combination.
That sounds exciting. What are the things inside the tumor that you'd be most interested in looking at?
Obviously, Herceptin has to work outside the cell by binding the extracellular components of the cell. There are cases where the extracellular portion can be cleaved, the so-called P95, which appears to leave even a more active oncogenic signal, and Herceptin can't bind to that, presumably can't help that. There's the question of, is P10 abnormalities make tumors more resistant to trastuzumab? And again, understanding then, are there times if the EGFR pathway seems to be activated concurrently with it, could there be an advantage there? I mean, a number of different things. A lot of it will be just exploratory to try and sort that out.
What about in the adjuvant setting in terms of the HER2 positive patient? Last time I talked to you, you guys were thinking about adding in bevacizumab on top of your base regimen. Is that still your thought?
Yeah, we're still developing a concept and hope to have that submitted fairly soon. We actually are committed to collaborate with Denny Slayman and BCIRG jointly on that concept. So we're working with them now actively. We've been waiting really on the pilot data that his group with Mark Pegram is leading that study with the TORI network, looking at the combination of Avastin and Herceptin as monotherapy for frontline HER2 positives to get safety data, activity data. And the trial's progressing well, and they told us that we'll be ready to present the data at San Antonio for the trial, from what we understand. It's not our trial, so we're depending on them to keep us posted, and from what they've been able to share with us, it looks like it's something that we definitely will be pursuing, very promising.
We've kind of started to rethink bevacizumab in terms of mechanism of action with the concept of improved delivery, potentially, of chemotherapy to tumors. What do we know about the potential synergy between bevacizumab and trastuzumab? Is that another potential situation of improved drug delivery? Is it more of a molecular interaction? What do we know about that?
There is a high association between when patients have HER2 amplification, a high percent in some of the series, like 3/4 of the patients also have VEGF upregulated. And when you have that combination with chemotherapy alone, those patients do not do well. They have a very strikingly poor outcome. So the assumption is that there's something mechanistically going on driving that. And if you shut both those down, you will improve outcome. And in the preclinical models, it looks very, very strong. That was the justification for taking it into the clinical trial. And they're clearly excited about things they're seeing. I haven't seen the data, but the study is continuing to accrue.
Where are we right now in terms of cardiac safety and trastuzumab, particularly the issue of the patient who's maybe older or with risk factors for heart disease?
To me, the really exciting thing about the adjuvant Herceptin data has been that it appears to me, it's I guess it's simplistic, but I think that it's helpful in the clinic, is it looks like really no matter how you use Herceptin, the patients derive a substantial benefit. Now, there are probably small differences amongst the different ways of doing it that we really can't definitively address now because trials weren't set up that way. But it's clear that Herceptin really is the most important element of therapy for a HER2-positive breast cancer patient. So just because a woman doesn't meet the eligibility criteria of the original trials doesn't mean that she shouldn't receive Herceptin. I think she should get the safest regimens. TCH certainly has low cardiac toxicity, but TCH is not a gentler regimen for an elderly woman either. You know, it is a fairly rigorous program in and of itself, though the cardiac toxicity is less. but I think given the tolerance to personally carbotaxol, Herceptin, that we use weekly in metastatic disease is clearly very active and well tolerated. Those are the sort of substitutions that I think personally would be reasonable to consider in an elderly patient if you felt like you needed to give her the chemotherapy. Obviously, you have the clinical judgment about, do we need to give chemo? Can we just use Herceptin? Can we just use hormone therapy? And the answer is, I think, to all those, you know, sure, you can. I mean, you have to make your clinical judgment there. Herceptin is active without chemotherapy. There's no question about that. If I'm going to give Herceptin, I would like to give the patient some kind of chemotherapy personally, maybe just four cycles of EC a la Hera or something.
What about a taxane without carboplatin? I'm curious what you thought about the paper at ASCO in the metastatic setting comparing TCH to docetaxel Herceptin without the carboplatin and what you think the implications might be.
Well, I mean, the problem with that study is it's a very different result than what was seen with Nick Robert's study with weekly Taxol. And they were both frontline metastatic studies, and there was a clear difference in Nick's study. It may be that with weekly Taxol, carboplatin is important, and with every three-week Taxotere, it isn't. Looking at the data, I have to accept it for what it is. It was a surprise to see that the TCH was not more effective than the TH, but the TH actually did very well. I mean, they did take the time to point out that on their assumptions, they were thinking TH would come in about where the Taxol Herceptin did, around 7 months, and they were hoping to move it out to 10 or 11 with TCH, and they did, but the TH came with them, so to speak. So clearly, Taxotere Herceptin is a very active combination, but there's toxicity that has to be factored into things.
Can you talk about what you think is a reasonable way to do cardiac monitoring with patients, and how does that vary by age?
For me, the precedent for the cardiac monitoring has been set by the adjuvant trials. I think the plan was a reasonable one. Check imaging halfway through the chemotherapy, check it at the end of chemotherapy, then check it again 3 months later. I think that makes a lot of sense. It made sense for the trial. I think it makes sense for the clinic. I think particularly in the B31 study and the N9831 study, we did stop drug in a significant number of patients, 15% of patients who had asymptomatic drops. You know, we don't know for sure that had we continued treating them that we would have seen a higher rate of clinical heart failure, but I think it's a reasonable assumption that that probably would have been the case. So I think in view of that, that's a reasonable way to proceed. And certainly if you've got somebody who you're going in concerned about their heart, so you're not going to follow the regimen, all the more reason to keep an eye on them. So I think those are reasonable intervals.
What do we know about variations in EF based on who does the test or when it's done?
A lot of discussion went on that actually it took a while to get the studies launched because of the recognition that there is a lot of variability in ejection fraction. Normally, there's a lot of variability just with the test itself. So when we get a report of an ejection fraction, there is a bit of a confidence interval, more or less, kind of plus minus 5 around that point. So they're not as precise as one would like, but we did pretty well using them in the trial. I think you just have to be consistent, try to use the same shop, you know, don't jump back and forth, echo mug it, and do what you can. But I think there's variability, but I don't see it personally as a problem that can't be dealt with.
Getting back to the issue of neoadjuvant therapy, can you update us on where we are with an NSABP neoadjuvant study in HER2-negative patients?
That's our B40 trial. That was originally going to be a three-arm study looking at sequential AC followed by Taxotere in three arms, Taxotere by itself, Taxotere with capecitabine, Taxotere with gemcitabine. And we were about to open the trial, but basically decided to pull it back and modify it to incorporate looking at bevacizumab. With that, we did reconfigure the study to move the taxanes ahead of the AC. That's a reversal of the, quote, usual order that the NSABP has done. But our thinking there was twofold. One is that the data that we have on breast cancer came in treatment with a taxane, with Taxol, so we wanted to give the two together as much as possible. And then there's also the concern still about the not totally resolved issue of possibility of increased cardiac toxicity of anthracyclines with the bevacizumab. More and more, it's looking like that probably isn't going to turn out to be a concern, but it has been there. And since you have to stop the bevacizumab a couple cycles before the surgery, it made sense from that perspective. So we basically have flipped the order, and now it's a 3x2 study. CIRB looked at it a couple days ago.
Can you update us on the NSABP B38 study?
B38 accrual is going extremely well. We're consistently over 180 patients a month accrued to the trial, so the community really has embraced it. We're very happy about that. And if we continue at that rate, we'll reach the 4,800 patients in a little over a year and close accrual.
Can you review the randomization there?
Sure.
And I'm curious how people are looking at that study now in view of some of the data that's come out in terms of estrogen receptor positive tumors and choice of chemotherapy.
There's three arms to the trial, and basically the one arm, in a sense, have two controls. We have the Taxotere control using the TAC regimen, the study by the BCIRG, and our Taxol control, so to speak, is the dose-dense Nortonian regimen. The third arm adds gemcitabine to the dose-dense Taxol portion of the program. So it's a three-arm trial in that sense. I guess what you're asking is, improvement with dose-dense therapy seemed to be mostly confined to the ER-negative patients, largely confined then. Does that mean that dose-dense isn't something for a receptor-positive patient? My view on it is that the dose-dense therapy, it certainly isn't less effective than every three-week therapy. Clearly, the big step is in ER-negative patients, but it still has advantages in that therapy does get over with quicker. We haven't seen that as a problem. We still think it is a viable option, because really the realities right now of adjuvant chemotherapy for node-positive patients is you probably should get an anthracycline, probably should get Cytoxan, they probably should get a taxane, and the recipes are all over the place. It does allow a lot of flexibility for off-protocol therapy for physicians and patients to make selections, but I think when you've got an active protocol that is looking basically at an optimal Taxotere regimen, an optimal paclitaxel regimen, and then a possible improvement, there's not a reason to reconfigure that study. I think the dose-dense arm still is a very reasonable treatment for patients with ER-positive, node-positive tumors.
As you've put patients on that study, what have you found in terms of side effects, tolerability of TAC versus, say, dose-dense AC paclitaxel?
You hear people that will make the statement that TAC is tougher. It's been very interesting looking at the toxicity tables. It really isn't coming out that way. The thing you do see from time to time with Taxotere, when people get infectious complications, sometimes they can get pretty sick with it. They can seem to be severe infections, but in terms of looking cross arms, we're really not seeing a difference. It's been surprising.
Of course, the growth factor is used in all three arms.
We're not seeing patients coming off study, not completing the therapy. So really the compliance to all three arms and tolerability has been remarkably good.
Same thing in terms of quality of life, fatigue.
Yeah, nothing's jumping out. Now, quality of life, of course, we're not tracking that as we're on the toxicity tables, but you do get reports of fatigue, but there's certainly not anything striking like grade 3 or, you know, real severe kinds of fatigue.
I want to ask you also about the trial with aromatase inhibitors looking at longer durations of 5 years. Can you talk about that study, what the design is, and where you're at with that?
Basically, it's a trial for patients who are finishing 5 years of largely aromatase inhibitor-based therapy, get randomized to a placebo, or in this study, we're using letrozole. And basically, patients can have received up to 3 years of tamoxifen and then convert over to an aromatase inhibitor. So actually, I said the majority. They need to at least have 2 years of the aromatase inhibitor to be eligible for the trial. So we're not limiting it to women who have received 5 years of an AI. We're allowing women who have had some tamoxifen and done the crossover, the IES.
And I guess this is one of the most common questions that oncologists have in practice. It's great that they're now going to have a trial that they can put patients on. What's your approach to the patient in a non-protocol setting who's just finishing 5 years of an AI? Do you bring up the option of continuing or you just stop them?
My honest answer to that is, since I've been in Pittsburgh 4 years, I'm not seeing those patients. So it's hard for me to say what I'm doing in my practice when I'm not seeing those patients. Obviously, our position with the trial is that we don't have evidence of benefit beyond 5 years, and that because of the bone density effects and so on, we need to understand the upside as well as potential downside, and so the trial is appropriate. So if you're going to do the trial ethically, then you have to be comfortable that that is the standard of care. So that's what I would recommend to patients, that there's just not evidence of benefit. One of the more difficult times for patients often is that the point when you stop treating them, an ER negative, she's always worrying, have I had enough cycles of this therapy? Do I need a few more? I think I could take a few more. ER positive patients, I'm doing well. Are we sure that we should stop it? For a while, everybody felt tamoxifen forever was a smart thing, and fortunately, the NSABP was able to do the trial that showed, no, it actually isn't. So we still think in the absence of data, it's best to get data.
The last thing I want to ask you about is the Oncotype DX assay. I know the paper has just been published looking at the B20 paper. Really, I think one of the most important studies has been done in breast cancer in the last 10 years or so. Can you summarize where we're at with that and where you think the Oncotype fits in right now in clinical practice?
Sure. I agree with you. I think the B20 result was a real mixed blessing, because without question, by adding chemotherapy, we have improved outcome for that group of patients. But the absolute increase was really small for the extent of therapy that a lot of women had to take. And so I think part of the deal with that trial was saying, okay, well, we have to do this now because we can't differentiate. And it's great now that we really can differentiate amongst these women with node negative ER positive breast cancer with the Oncotype test. What I feel like the data shows us is for half of the women, you can be pretty certain with them about benefit or not from chemotherapy. They have a high recurrence score. The data is striking about the magnitude of the benefit. The absolute improvement they get with CMF is 28%. I mean, it's incredible.
75% reduction in recurrence rate.
Yeah. I mean, the relative risk is 75, but the absolute step, because we used to tell women you need chemo for 4 or 5. In reality, we found a group where it's 28, and I think that's an important one, too, because in the past, clearly, if a woman was very hesitant about chemotherapy, she might decide 4% isn't worth it. But if she's in that 28% group, she may think differently. So I think it's very helpful in letting those high-risk women know that chemotherapy is particularly important in you, and you're going to get a lot out of this, not a little bit. The other end of the spectrum, of course, then are the low recurrence score patients, where we've learned that they actually do better than what we had to tell them when we averaged everybody together. They do better with their hormone therapy, and we can also say that there just isn't evidence that the chemotherapy pushes that number up higher. We have the group in the middle, the intermediate risk patients. And I think it's important for clinicians to understand about the categories of high, intermediate, and low is that those bins were created for the purposes of statistical analysis. There's not a huge difference between a patient's risk with a recurrence score of 29 and 31. We put them in different bins, but 29 has a lot more similarity with a 31 than she does the 20s. And so basically the intergroup has come up with, in the Taylor studies, a very pragmatic, appropriate decision where we more or less say, well, women on the upper end of the intermediate score, really, they're benefiting. They should be given chemo like a high risk. The upper end of the upper portion of the low recurrent score patients might be a little bit of benefit there. Let's talk to women about randomizing them in the study. So I think that Taylor trial does make a lot of sense right now, and it will give us that information about that in-between patients where we don't know the answer. But I think out on the ends, the Oncotype helps a great deal. Now, there are some patients where probably the Oncotype probably isn't as reliable, real large tumors, that we didn't have many tumors at all above 4 centimeters. We didn't have many women under the age of 40. You know, there's some situations where we're not as certain about the reliability. There are also things like clearly high-grade Nottingham 8 and 9 tumors virtually always are going to be intermediate to high. HER2 positives, and so you don't really learn a lot from the assay on those patients. So I don't think it's a case that everybody needs it. But boy, for your 1 to 3 centimeter grade 2 tumors, to me, it's very helpful.
I know you all are actively pursuing a project with Genomic Health looking at an assay in colon cancer, which is quite a bit behind the breast cancer effort, but you just reported data at ASCO that was interesting and encouraging. Where do you see the group heading in terms of breast cancer in the Oncotype? Are there any studies being discussed, or are you mainly just going to participate in the Taylor study?
Right now, we're supporting the Taylor trial, and we're very fortunate to have Soon Pate, director of our molecular pathology, and he continues to work with other companies, other techniques to refine things. I think the thing that we're intrigued with, assays like the Oncotype, would those tests provide better information on hormone receptor status, on HER2 status, than our immunohistochemical stains? And these are things that we're continuing to look at and evaluate to see if that might be a better way to predict the cut points of who is truly ER positive and who is ER negative. Are we sure that our current immunohistochemical line is the correct line? So that's where we're working, I guess, right now, what we hope we can report on fairly soon.